Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello, this is Karen Tynan with the Ogletree Deacons Podcast. I'm a shareholder in the Sacramento, California office. And here with me today in part of our series on SB 553 is Greg Sir. And you may recognize that name, so I'm going to let him provide an introduction. And I want you to hear the details about all of his experience, and you're the guy to do it. So, Greg, tell everybody who you are and why we're going to be talking about workplace violence.
Well, I appreciate you having me, Karen. My name is Greg Sir, and I was a 35-year police officer in San Francisco. My last 5 years, I was chief of police here in San Francisco.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great time to be a cop. I came in 1981. Actually, that, you know, right there, 49ers win the first Super Bowl. It was pretty cool.
Wow, with the satin jackets, right?
There you go. There you go. But we got to see just so much evolution for certain technology over those 35 years. But sadly, also from as recent as like when I was in the FTO program, our first workplace violence active shooter was back in 1982 at One Market Plaza. Gentleman walked in pretending that he had flowers for his wife. He ended up shooting and killing her.
And you were on the force then?
I was. I was yes. Brand new. I was literally like, I didn't have a year in the police department. And okay. I ended up on the 18th floor where the shooting happened. We were just about to go in when SWAT took the guy out before he could hurt anybody else. But again, 8 people were wounded and 3 were killed in that particular event. And that was kind of my first taste of what was going to evolve over the next 40 years into some of these horrific shootings that we've had over time. As a sergeant, I was at 101 California back in 1993. We were one of the first units on scene. I was playing closed narcotics.
Okay.
And again, that's actually the one that resulted in the assault weapons ban that Senator Feinstein put in, and that 8 people were killed. And 6 others were injured in that one. So that was kind of the first one, at least here in San Francisco or California, that people remember that particular shooting at that law firm. That particular shooter took his own life in a stairwell as we were all arriving on scene.
Now, I think it's important for people to realize that there's been a big change over these decades into how we view workplace violence active shooters. And in fact, I remember when 101 California was happening, I was actually on Market Street and,
oh, wow.
You know, saw the police lights, and then it was on the news that night and didn't really comprehend someone walking into a workplace with a firearm and just going at it, right? It was so unusual. And I hate to say it, but in 2024, that's very different.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember back then it was mid-afternoon. And people were calling 911 saying that there was a guy going in with a gun, and then he was getting on the elevator. And we were almost incredulous, like, really? But when the second call came, whoa, this has to be legit. And we were all actually doing an off-duty security thing at KKR at the time, overnight on midnights. So we knew people in the building. We were very familiar with the building, which ended up paying off and resulted in us calling some folks and getting them to secure in place, and no one was harmed. But these are all things that we almost have in our common lexicon now, that back then there was no plan for this kind of stuff. It just didn't happen.
So SB 553, which is the new California workplace violence law, it does not have a particular requirement for active shooter training or active shooter drills. But obviously, a lot of people and California employers are asking, how do I understand the risk? And you actually educated me that it's not just active shooters. It's kind of this idea of an active aggressor.
Right.
It may not be a gun. It may be another kind of weapon. So can you talk a little bit with your thoughts about how to understand the risk that California employers can be facing of these type of incidents, how to understand the risk. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think if you called out or if the Senate bill had called out just specifically active shooter, I think that they made it broad deliberately, right? So that whatever training you do, it's going to have to be an all hazards training, right? So the law says itself, a comprehensive workplace violence prevention plan.
Okay? Right.
So absent somebody actually defining that, to me, that means that you have to plan for everything, right?
Right.
So, I mean, we've been doing fire drills since we were children. And unfortunately, these days, to do what, like in a school, for instance, to evacuate would be the exact opposite of what you would want children to do or if you had an active shooter in the hallway.
Right.
Because you wouldn't want to evacuate into the threat.
And is that something that's been learned over the years? Has that changed the advice maybe that was given, say, in year 1990 or year 2000 compared with now? I want to understand that.
Yeah. So there was another unfortunate shooting that everybody remembers back in Colorado in 1999 at Columbine. But back then, the training for police was that you responded, set up a command post, came up with a plan. You went in. Well, the two high school students that carried that shooting and attempted bombing out, they were just randomly walking around. And that resulted in the move to threat training that I had just made it onto the command staff here in San Francisco at Special Operations. And we were charged with implementing that. With when you get somewhere, if you can hear the infliction of serious injury or active life taking, you have to move to the threat. You don't get to wait. You go with whatever you have and you have to move in. For fire drills, it's always evacuate, right? So
right.
You hear the bell, you go. So now, you know, they've gone to audible. And again, in schools, it's absolutely lock the door, get under
right.
your desk, secure in place until law enforcement comes and lets you know that it's all clear.
And thinking about California industries, you know, agriculture's big. We have a lot of manufacturing. We have high tech. You're in this big, beautiful office building. Do you see some differences for employers? Let's say compare, you know, an employer that's in a big office building, you know, many stories and maybe a number of employers compared to, say, a single manufacturing. How do you kind of tell that employer how they should examine the risk or some things they should think about?
Well, I think the first thing is don't assume it can't happen here.
Okay.
Right. So that's the thing is you're going to have people that subscribe to that, you know, oh, it's not going to happen here. Right. For instance, mm-hmm. we had a shooting in 2017 here in the city. The shooter actually set off a metal detector and they disregarded the alarm. And he went walking in with the guns and he kills people, right?
Okay.
The actual legislation, many people think, came from last year, almost happened a year ago while we're doing this podcast, of the shootings farms down in Half Moon Bay. That's a farm, right?
So, right.
And then some of these other shootings that I've mentioned all happened in office spaces. And then, of course, the other one that was just horrendous, the law enforcement response that the DOJ just came out with a report on was the shooting down in at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas, where the police did not move to the threat for over an hour. For those of us in law enforcement, there's just no excuse that the training's been the way it's been for over 20 years. You got to go, and they didn't go. So I think what I would tell all these businesses is, you know, you got to sit with somebody and you got to come up with a plan as to how you want your folks to respond should they get some sort of an alert. And the guidance is pretty basic across the board, and it's run, hide, fight, right? So it's my colleague at the other building that we own here in San Francisco, our company, is run. If you're an adult, think about running again. If you haven't already considered running, you should really think about running.
Okay.
Then hide. And then there's all sorts of things you can do that are smart when you're hiding. You know, you want to be behind cover, which is something that would block a bullet versus concealment, right, which would be like a curtain. Silence your cell phone. You don't want to be the kid on Scream,
right,
that calls the guy to you. And then finally, if discovered, you got to fight. And that's kind of the thing. But there's so many other nuances in this training, right? And you want to have a dialogue back and forth. This is not a question of that's the wrong thing to do. Everybody has to make their decision in that moment.
Right.
And nobody knows in a fight or flight situation how they're going to react. So you just have to respect what everybody decides. Certainly try to get everybody to run if you think it's safe to do so.
Right.
But they may think you're crazy to be running. And they may end up being the one that was right. You don't know. Everybody has to do what's best for themselves.
Well, you know, you told a story. I want to tell you a little story. I was up in Washington last year for some depositions. I was in a small hotel chain, and I was on the third floor. About 7:30, I'm getting ready to head to the deposition. And I hear what I think is the news, and I hear police and some banging. And I thought, why is the news, you know, live or whatever? But then about 30 seconds later, I heard very loud banging, and the officer said the guy's name, you know, John Smith, this is so-and-so, come out. And you're in room 302, come out, and, you know, whatever, gave him instructions. Well, I was in room 304 next door. Okay. So I go to the bathroom on the other side of the room, and I call the desk, and they're not answering. But I know enough not to stick my head out the door.
Yeah, that's smart.
So then I'm in the bathroom. I call my husband. He doesn't answer. So then I call my associate, Robert. And he says, I think you need to call 911 and ask them what to do, because you're on the third floor. You can't jump out the window. And I'm looking, and the bathtub is whatever, ceramic, steel, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, okay, these are thin walls at the, you know, $99 a night hotel. I'm going to lay in that bathtub if I have to, right? And I can hear some rustling in the hallway. I end up on a call with 911, and they end up with the SWAT team at the location. They coach me. I'm on the phone. I've got my suitcase, and I can hear the 911 operator. And then they tell me to open the door, announce myself. The SWAT guy says, Karen, run towards my voice. And I'm running down the hall, dragging my suitcase, and I get out of there. But it definitely, I did not want to stay there in a dangerous situation. I hadn't pre-talked about this with you, but that was a time when I definitely did not want to be next door. I thought to myself, you know, this could be a gunfight with a bunch of thin walls. I don't want to be here.
So first, I'd love to know how long your husband heard about not answering the phone, because I can only imagine, right? That said, you did exactly the right thing. Right. So first of all, I mean, you're calm to follow those measures. Not everybody would be like that. Right.
Right.
And then your courage to act when the officers told you to do what you do, because technically when you're in that hallway, you're in harm's way because you don't know. So but this situation you're describing, though it could have turned into an active shooter situation, this is actually a barricaded suspect. Mm-hmm. So he's not actively shooting, actively inflicting danger. So this is where they found the Uvalde Police Department at fault in the DOJ report. They treated it like a barricaded suspect situation instead of an active shooter. And it was, that's 100% wrong. And
I'm glad I told this story so you could make the distinction.
Right. And there's a big difference, right? So,
okay.
And that's why you listening and doing what you did, that's like what I was saying, like you can't make a person do something. You would have been completely within reason to say, hey, I'm safe right here. I got a cast iron bathtub. I'm not going. And then they would have just had to make sure that they knew you were there. And now they have to guard that door so he can't get in there, right? Or improvise and told you, get in that bathtub. But what you did literally is kind of what we're talking about in having a plan. Right? You want to have that conversation we just had with your employees, whoever mm-hmm. they are. And then when you're going to get questions where you would say, no, you wouldn't do that.
Okay.
Or yes, that's exactly a course of action you might want to take. You know, because somebody might say, you know, hey, what about just talking to the guy? I just want to, you know, anybody, everybody will listen to me. No, no, not, this is not that, right? So there's certain things you just absolutely don't do. And engaging the suspect would be one of them.
Gotcha. Now, a lot of employers, and you've touched on the training aspect, they really wonder, well, if I do engage and have active shooter training, active threat, active aggressor training, is it going to be traumatizing to people? Should people be able to opt out? You know, is it too much because, quote unquote, I don't think it could happen here, or I think my facility's too small? What do you say to those kind of employers who maybe have a little bit of doubt about having the active shooter training?
Great question. There are people where maybe they were already in an active shooter situation. Maybe they lost a loved one in an active shooter situation. Maybe some sort of a video or whatever is going to trigger them, right? So whenever we do the training here, I preface my comments with, hey, you know, we do our regular fire training, our earthquake training, our, you know, basically how to avoid some of the street behavior here in San Francisco training. And then I'll say, hey, now I'm going to do the active shooter portion of our training. If anybody, this is going to trigger anybody, feel free to leave. We will do the training. And then if you want to come back, I will give you just the basics to keep yourself safe, which is really just the run, hide, fight piece to the training, right? But they don't have to subject themselves to, I mean, depending on who does the training, you know, there are more videos out there that are more potentially upsetting than you can count.
Right.
And some people, that's what you need to get their attention to realize the gravity of the situation. But there's other people, again, where it would do more harm to them than good. And so allow those people in out and then bring them back in just to give them the basics on your plan, on that if we do have a situation, God forbid, this is what everybody else is going to do and you should consider too.
Now, I had also spoken with you, you know, Robert Rodriguez, my colleague and I, we had a murder case in the summer of 2022 where a person got a knife out. Their supervisor confronted them about stealing materials, and it ended up being a knife fight for their life. And as they spilled out of an office and through a door, the employees were just stunned. They were almost paralyzed by seeing this stabbing. I mean, it was awful. And then the person, after the victim fell on the ground, he had been stabbed, very just awful. They just walked out to their car. Everyone was just so stunned. They didn't run away. They just really didn't know what to do. And so that's another case. It's not the active shooter, but it's the active aggressor. Do you think that should also be covered in training? It's not just what if someone has a gun, but how do we handle whether it's that someone, you know, sets a bomb or there's, you know, knives? What do you think of at least including that element? Is it too much? Is it too detailed, or is it worthwhile?
No, it's absolutely worthwhile. I mean, like, again, the training we do, if a suspicious package is found, I mean, you don't have to call it a bomb, but you know, we all remember after 9/11, right? There were anthrax packages, there were suspicious, you know, and, you know, maybe they got oil, they got the bad label, the tape job's crazy, there's a wire, whatever, right? You want people to know what to do. And you know, we're just talking about this now in January of 2024, right? If this is January of 2044, and we're talking about this, I mean, We know, you know, we're not children, and we remember from when we were children exactly what to do in a fire drill. So 20 years from now, you just want it to be rote memory on what you do. And in the instance of the edged weapon, the knife attacker, I think that in that instance, you know, hopefully people know, call 911, videotape it, get away, get at a safe distance, right? I mean, if someone feels like jumping in and trying to save the person's life, again, that's their personal decision to make. You know, the law enforcement will come and they are required to put themselves in harm's way to save that person's life. The other is when it's over with, you can't leave. You were all a witness to what happened. You have to stay and tell the story. And or if not, someone has to try and keep track of the suspect so that you can direct the police to that person before they hurt somebody else.
No, that's a good point of at least walking through with employees. If we do have something happen here, you know, what are we going to do maybe in addition to 911? And then depending on the workplace, I've heard from some consultants and I've talked with you about how there seem to be a lot of people getting into this space, whether they should or not. We'll leave that aside. I've even heard some consultants talking about training employees to be, you know, active bystanders and bystanders who, you know, put themselves out there to stop workplace violence. I have to tell you, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that.
No, your plan can't require people to put themselves in harm's way. It's just not, you know, I mean, everybody's got different physical capabilities. It's just not something that anybody can do. I mean, again, you know, when you become a police officer or a firefighter, the military, you swear an oath that you're going to put yourself in harm's way, right? And right. Those are the people that you can expect to do that. You know, if somebody works for you at an accounting firm, it's not an ancillary duty to put yourself in a knife fight or a gunfight.
No, I think that's really great advice. And I notice you say police. You know, I'm from the South. We say police.
Police, yeah. We'll put our sheriffs in there too.
Okay. So I also want to ask you, there's a top question from California employers about how are they going to harden their facilities? You know, I went through your security today in your building. What are some of your thoughts on hardening facilities to workplace violence?
Well, again, it kind of runs the gamut, right, for expense. The least expensive are policies and procedures, right? So, you know, if you come up with very, you know, significant visitor and guest policies, you know, a single point of entry, maybe you control a door with something as simple as a buzzer or a speaker.
Okay.
All the way up to having, like, downstairs, because of the shooting down in San Bruno back in 2018, we have a San Francisco police officer on overtime in the lobby here from 7 in the morning till 7 at night. In uniform. Okay. So that's armed. So that's the most expensive. Everything in between is access control, elevator control, cameras with video analytics. Even we have a few tenants here that have panic alarms. And then we have procedures on how we respond to that. We don't call them panic alarms. Anyway, they're panic alarms.
Yeah. The red button is somewhere.
And they are red buttons, right? So, and they have those because of some of these prior events, right? And so just to make sure it happens, it goes to their contractor who calls 911, and then it goes to our security operations center that you visited. We call 911. They let me know. I have still have certification. I'll go upstairs. Everybody responds up. We'll hold the elevator open and respond like it's a medical emergency or a fire to expedite law enforcement to the floor. There's a whole procedure that goes in. So any of that or anywhere in between, but for certain, what's your business's policy on who should be on site versus who shouldn't be on site? And so like you were saying today, right? So you had to give your name.
Yes.
They asked before you get in, you get upstairs, they ask your name again.
Yes.
I come down, I take you through.
And they gave me a look over too. They wanted to make sure I was who I said I was. Yeah. You know, it's not an uncomfortable stare, but they're looking at you.
Sure. And again, you know, whenever we have deliveries, they're required to leave their driver's license if they enter the building in order to get a card. Every tenant has different requirements for who gets to get in their space and how. So, you know, but again, you know, this is a virtually brand new building, only 5 years old. So we have pretty much state of the art everything. And not every building has a former chief of police as the head of security.
These guys are pretty lucky here.
So we think about that stuff all the time, because no one can ever tell me it can't happen here, because I've seen it happen everywhere.
Well, what you've made me think of when you talk about controlling access into a facility, I kind of ask you this off the cuff. It's certainly not a practice kind of question. But, you know, like when I go to a game, I go through a metal detector. Mm-hmm. And what do you think is the value of metal detectors? Because I always kind of wonder, like, oh, maybe, you know, is it just keeping out a big weapon, you know, at a big kind of venue, or what do you think of those?
So we use them a lot here in San Francisco at like some of our big outdoor concerts. I think probably the highest value is it gives someone pause.
A deterrence, kind of?
Yeah, because there's usually police officers in relative proximity to these metal detectors. If I'm a bad actor and I have a gun or a knife or whatever, I'm not going to risk going through and then all of a sudden I'm engaging with the cops. That said, I just got two fake hips last Christmas. I set the metal detector off every time.
Right.
And I tell them, and they kind of almost like don't give me a second look. They just kind of assume. So it's not foolproof,
right.
But I do think it gives a bad actor pause. And and to absent having that law enforcement present or a good security guard present there to really scrutinize what somebody's doing, you could fall into a situation where the guy is late for work, sets it off, somebody knows him from every single day and just says, go ahead and go through. And he went through it too again.
I like that you're able to tell kind of stories to illustrate this. Now, here's a question that a lot of California employers are asking about their plan. And can their workplace violence plan have parts that are confidential or restricted, like parts about communications during an incident, parts about how they're going to analyze threats. Do you have some thoughts about what might be front-facing to the employees in a workplace violence plan and the cards that you may keep closer to your chest?
So you absolutely do not have to make any contact information, phone numbers, people, whatever. That doesn't need to be public, right? If you had a threat assessment done or a gap analysis on what your vulnerabilities are, no vulnerability assessment needs to be part of any plan. Your plan is going to be a result of that gap analysis or threat assessment, right? But the plan itself, by rule, has to be available and easily accessible to all employees.
Yes.
So from a ton of the stuff that I've read and we do here, it's on our intranet. So anybody that wants to see our emergency operations plan can go right to the intranet and see it. And I think that's a good thing.
I like it when clients have safety documents and plans on the intranet so you can look at it when you need it or when you have a question about it or thought. You like that too?
There are a million, everybody in this, whenever something happens, there's a giant spike in Google activity regarding active shooters, that event. Well, I can guarantee you people are going to be asking either for a refresher training, new training, whatever, or they're going to be going to your site where you have your plan to
That's a good point.
To find it and see what it is. And if not, they should. I mean, we do it here all the time. When something happens, kind of what I used to do in the police department, any calamity that happened anywhere around the world, we would assume like it happened here in San Francisco and we would see how prepared we are or trained to it, do a tabletop. Just kind of, hey, what would we do if that happened here? And that's a great thing to do to keep your plans fresh and evolving. You know, somebody said, you know, hey, how important is the plan? And I go, I always say, you know, Eisenhower once said that the secret's not the plan, it's to plan. Because your document's going to be a living document. You know, you're required again by this legislation. After every training and after every event, you're supposed to do a after action, a hot wash. And what did we do well? What could we have done better? And then you have to incorporate that into your plan. And that's supposed to be subject to inspection by who's ever doing the enforcement.
Cal OSHA is going to be looking at this.
So your plan, whatever's your initial plan, there's going to be version 12 or 13 or 15 down the road that's a much better plan.
I like how you're saying that. So California employers should understand that it's continuous improvement.
Right.
Always. So as we finish up here, and I could talk to you for hours, you know that, Greg, this is awesome.
Back at you.
So if you were talking to a room full of California employers, and essentially we are on this podcast, do you have some final takeaways that you'd like to share for them about SB 553 workplace violence planning for this? Just give us some takeaways.
Yeah. So I would say if you aren't already doing most, if not all, of what's required in this legislation, you probably already should have been. So this is more like a wake-up call, because there is a lot of exposure. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of risk. It would be very hard for an attorney to be able to defend that you don't have anything, because somebody's going to give you, when they have an unfortunate act, and hopefully it's not to the degree of an active shooter, but it could be anything. Right. And they're going to say, hey, nobody knew what to do. Mm-hmm. You gave them no direction. There was no plan. You didn't have any access control, even a written policy on who gets in, who gets out. There was no this, there was no that. And if you're empty, if you have no response, it
we're evolved. Not asking for perfection,
right? And it doesn't have to be, break the bank, but you have to have something. And to have a basic all hazards plan that for instance, here we train annually, we're a relocation building because we're so tall, but that's essentially our fire drill. So every year, 2 weeks before our annual fire drill, everybody in this building is invited to, and we have it virtually, an all hazards training that does fire, earthquake, medical emergencies, neighborhood safety, and workplace violence.
That sounds like great. I hope the employers listen to that, because I would love to see employers adopt that.
Sure. I think, and in the workplace great. Violence is yes. the suspicious package piece as well.
Awesome. So thank you, Greg. And thank you to our listeners for joining us for the Ogletree Deacons podcast. This is Karen Tynan. Stay safe and look for our other podcast on ogletree.com.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.